Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Greetings and welcome to this podcast series for the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. I am Ian McDuff and I'm coming to you from Wellington in New Zealand. And it's my pleasure to be your host for this series and to welcome you to this inaugural podcast. As the name of the podcast indicates, this will be a series of conversations in the burgeoning but now hardly new field of online dispute resolution and digital access to justice. And I'm going to be talking with many of the leading pioneers and innovators in this field. I'm not going to expand at this stage on what the series of conversations will be about. That's going to be as much of a surprise to me as it will be to you as we engage with those various colleagues. But the purpose of our explorations will be to find out where we've come from in this field and where we think we're heading. In this opening conversation, I'm delighted, privileged, pleased to be chatting with the leading pioneer in the field, Professor Ethan Katch. Hello, Ethan. Ethan is the founder and the immediate past director of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution. And as Ethan himself has been keen to say, the term National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution is probably now a bit of a misnomer because of the international scope of the membership of that group. He's Professor Emeritus of Legal Studies at University of Massachusetts Amherst, co-author most recently with Orna Rabinovich-Aini of Digital Justice, Technology and the Internet of Disputes, and it's a book that I warmly recommend to anyone interested in this field. Ethan is widely recognized as the founder in this field of online dispute resolution, to which I'll refer as ODR from now on. Along with Janet Riskin, he's conducted the eBay pilot project in 1999, which led to eBay's current system, which handles, at last count, 60 million disputes a year, but goodness knows what it is now. Co-edited the major text on ODR, Online Dispute Resolution Theory and Practice, now in its second edition in 2021. And in 2017 was the recipient of the D'Alembert Raven Award from the American Bar Association section of dispute resolution. Above all, Ethan, you have been the pioneer, mentor, colleague, and friend to those of us working in this field for over the last two decades. Welcome, Ethan, to this first ODR podcast. Good to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great. Ethan, I'm going to come back in a little while to ask you a bit about your own history in this field and how someone who's a professor of legal studies ends up being tangled in technology. it's one of these things that happens to us. But just for the sake of understanding across the field, what is it we're talking about when we refer to online dispute resolution?
Well, we're talking about systems for resolving disputes. I think the first thing that's should be known is that the numbers of disputes we have in society keep increasing. Any of you who have read Fisher and Urey's Getting to Yes may recall there's a line in there that conflict is a growth industry. That was 30 years ago, 20 years ago. Conflict today is a super growth industry, and we need to look around for systems and tools that can help us resolve those without enormous human involvement.
Okay, so leads me to the question about your involvement in this and your pathway. What is it that led you as a professor of legal studies, teaching law and society and other important contextual courses, led you to think that it's technology rather than improving the processes of law or in addition to improving the processes of law? Why technology?
Well, at the heart of technology is the use of information, the processing of information, the communication of information. I mean, if you think about what judges do or what mediators do or what lawyers do, they work with information. So I wasn't teaching in a law school. I had fairly free rein about what interests I wanted to pursue. And I just thought of that this was an age in which computers would we're doing more and more. And computers process information, arbitrators and mediators and judges and everybody else in the legal system processes and communicates information. So it just seemed easy to say there are connections there. And I do want to give credit to my colleague, Jana Rifkin, who was one of the, she called herself one of the grandmothers of a dispute resolution. She was active in the alternative dispute resolution field from the beginning. So I had a terrific resource to rely on.
All right. So she was, is a colleague of yours at UMass?
Yes, she was at UMass.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure we met at a conference, but not on technology, but on the ADR rather than the ODR field. So her work still extends to the ADR field. So technology, when you started in this field, and I don't want this to make us sound incredibly old, but the technology at the time you began would have been far simpler and clunkier than it is now. Holding less of a promise, I suppose, than it does now, or a peril.
Well, technology wasn't as universal as it is today, obviously, but 1981 was the year in which the IBM PC surfaced.
Wow.
The Apple machine, personal computer, surfaced, I think, a little earlier than that. I got my first computer about 1985.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it wasn't, the environment wasn't the way it is today, but it was easy to see that, for example, it was easy to see that television was not really the future. Computers were the future. That's how I looked at it.
Yeah. I guess some of the pioneers, even before the dispute resolution element, some of the pioneers in law and technology were doing exactly as you said. They were dealing with the information aspect of law, access to cases online, or digitizing the kinds of resources that lawyers use. So there was a bit of groundwork laid even before folks like you moved into the dispute resolution realm.
Well, I was, again, lucky. There were at the time, not a lot of people, but more than a handful of faculty on law schools who were interested in technology. Some were interested because of intellectual property issues. Sure. Some were interested in how you do legal research using technology. But again, everybody was interested sort of in the same thing. And fortunately, there were no rivalries. There were too few of us to have a rivalry.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting time.
Yeah, I guess there may have been no rivalry, but you might have been regarded with some puzzlement by your colleagues who were, you know, some of whom may still have been the hard left law. And of course, we may come back to this, but there's still that degree of resistance, or at least lack of curiosity about this field. Could you say something about the very early initiatives that you were involved in at UMass, because they were really pioneering?
Well, we, all of what I've just told you about did end up in a book published in 1989 called The Electronic Media and the Transformation of Law. So when I look back at that book, that was a long time ago. You could ask, well, how was there even enough to write about? I got some things right and I got some things wrong. But it was an interesting experience. Again, I was very lucky not only to have Jana Rifkin as a colleague, but several other people in the department also recognized that technology was the future. And I was not the first one to own or to try to program machines.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good time for experimenting. And fortunately, I was at an institution that was willing to let faculty do what they want as long as they were productive.
Great. And your early involvement also with eBay, could you say, in the eBay dispute resolution processes, could you say something about that?
Yeah, well, I could start every answer by saying I was lucky. I was lucky with 1998. I just got a telephone call, no emails then, or a telephone call out of the blue from somebody at eBay who wanted to talk to me about online dispute resolution. Mm. And I mean, the secret there was that eBay had bought another auction company called Up for Sale. Mm. And there were six University of Cincinnati law school students who had created an online auction. They weren't as successful as eBay, but they eBay bought them and for a considerable sum of money. But eBay didn't know what to do with these people. They were lawyers, but what could they do? So I think it was the general counsel of eBay who decided they would find out whether it would be possible to mediate disputes that occurred between buyers and sellers. And even then, they recognized clearly that if you have huge numbers of transactions, you're going to have huge numbers of disputes.
Sure. Yeah. Which echoes one of your earlier comments, which you've made in a couple of places, which is to the effect that we discovered, perhaps to our disappointment, that the internet, which purports to bring us together to enhance communication, as at least one author has said, to lead to world peace. I think she changed that in the second edition of her book and lost an element of optimism. But your comment echoing Fisher and Urey is that the internet is, like the rest of the world, not a peaceful place. So the internet itself generates disputes, doesn't it? And
well, it facilitates the generation of disputes, for sure. I mean, what I realized early on was that disputes come from two sources: one, transactions, and one, relationships. If transactions go bad, you end up with a dispute. If relationships go bad, you end up with a dispute. Maybe there are other elements involved, but if you keep your eye on transactions and relationships, I think you'll find everything.
Yeah. And I guess those lawyers who are involved in family property disputes find a lovely combination of both transactions. And those are the ones that turn out to be the most intractable when the relationships and the transactions go wrong. Yeah. So part of your earlier observation as well, if I go back through your earlier work, you referred to something which has become a bit of a, it's almost a meme, but it's certainly a metaphor, your reference to technology as the fourth party. Can you say something about that? I mean, whether that's a baby you still want to claim or not, I don't know.
No, I'll claim ownership of that. It's not valuable in any way, but I was writing a book with Janet in around 1981. The book was called, I think, Dispute Resolution in Cyberspace. And thinking about the role of technology, and normally one considers alternative dispute resolution as having three parties: plaintiff, defendant, and mediator or arbitrator. And courts have judges and two parties. So somehow it came to me that technology could be considered the fourth party. It was just a metaphor that was worth trying out. It seems to have lasted or even been revived in recent years.
Well, it certainly seems to have captured the idea that there's something or someone else there. Is there a sense in which that fourth party, I mean, is a presence that's there? It's there to facilitate the conversation. It's increasingly used, but it's also a potential obstacle. I don't know if you've seen the British film I, Daniel Blake.
No, I haven't.
It's a wonderful, quite a dark film, but nevertheless wonderful. But the central character is a chap who's lost his job. He's seeking benefits, and obviously doesn't own a computer, but needs to access his benefits that he's entitled to from the government. And the only way in which he can do that is through a computer, which he doesn't have. So he has to go to a library, but he has no idea how to use these things. And so the fact that he has to use the fourth party is an obstacle. And we're certainly finding that here in New Zealand, where we got a digital first policy on the government to make everything accessible digitally, which becomes an obstacle to precisely those for whom those benefits are intended. So your fourth party is friend, but sometimes foe, isn't it?
Well, I hope more friend than foe, but I can understand what's happening there. Early on, we struggled with the notion of the digital divide. What would happen? How could you require people to use computers if they didn't have the resources to learn how to use them or to actually use them? I think we're over time. There's less and less concern about that, but it remains a concern. Mobile phones have taken up some of the issue. Almost everybody seems to have a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm always cognizant of this digital divide, and we haven't erased it by any means.
Yeah. And it was just a comment on our news this morning about the impact of the pandemic on education, because kids have basically here, I don't know if it's the position in the States or elsewhere, but kids have been at home for much of their education over the last 2 years with our various lockdowns. And that has impacted in different ways on kids who don't have the same access to the digital technology, although the government and one of our major broadband providers have made a huge effort in making sure that people have not only access to the technology, the hardware, but also to the broadband, to the medium, I should say. So we're aware of the impact, but the impact is not gone, but it's diminishing. Could you, Ethan, say something about the way in which you see the obstacles still to ODR, whether they come from the legal profession, from finance, from government? What do you see as some of the roadblocks that we're still facing?
Well, one roadblock that's not there anymore is that I'm not asked about the problem of meeting in cyberspace, with not meeting face-to-face. I used to be asked by mediators, how can you resolve any disputes if you're not face-to-face? And I think one thing we learned from the pandemic is, you can resolve disputes when you're at a distance if you have the right software.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that it's as easy to resolve a dispute face-to-face and online as it is face-to-face. But ironically, the pandemic has supported a lot of use of the internet for resolving disputes at a distance.
And I don't know whether you've seen this amongst whatever networks and colleagues you have, but I've certainly seen on the mediators who are on LinkedIn, some of the ones who were the very opposition to going online before the pandemic, and now the proud enthusiasts of the technology, showing their triple screens and their professional microphones, and the fact that they dress formally from the waist up have their business jacket over the back of the chair and have wholeheartedly adopted this. Some of them also enthusiastically, as soon as they possibly can, getting back on airplanes and flying to exotic destinations to do their mediations. But there has been a kind of conversion experience, hasn't there, in the last couple of years?
Yes. Yes, I think conversion experience captures it.
And although that's uneven, my impression is that there are many more courts in the US which are moving towards at least some adoption of digital technologies. Some, say here in New Zealand or Australia, adopted of necessity during the lockdowns, but have returned to the bricks and mortar version of courts and people actually in court. So there's not a wholesale adoption, a partial conversion of counsel, but not of the courts necessarily.
Yeah, I think if you take a look at our website, which is odr.info, there's a map somewhere there.
There is.
Of yes. the number of courts around the globe that are online that will handle, that have ODR.
Yeah.
There are a lot of those, but there are a lot of them, a lot of courts that still go by the old way.
Yeah. And what's exciting also about that map, which has just been put up there by Leah Wing, is that it's almost a crowdsourced map, in that
right.
colleagues are invited to add the courts that are there, because obviously Leah and colleagues can't put everything there themselves. So yes, I mean it's exciting in that these developments are taking place. Here we are, 2022. Next 5 years, where do you think we might end up? This is where you haul out your crystal ball and imagine what, not only what you imagine, but what you would hope to see in the ODR field.
Well, I would hope to see that the ODR field can have an impact on the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, one's perspective on how technology is being used doesn't lead one to be all that optimistic, but I think there are opportunities for the ODR field to grow.
Yeah.
I mean, the old model was you had courts, and then you had ADR, alternative dispute resolution. Over time, alternative dispute resolution became really not the alternative. Courts were the alternative. And I think we're heading towards a situation in which ADR may become the alternative again, because ODR becomes the most commonly used system for resolving problems.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, there are good practical and fiscal reasons for that too. I mean, when I used to live in Singapore until 2016, just before I left there, there was a clear move from the Chief Justice to move a number of the functions of the courts online, and that is only partially a function of distance. It's only 45 kilometers wide, so it's not a huge issue with distance, but there are issues of convenience and just rapid access to the courts. There's an efficiency function there, which goes back to some of your earlier thoughts about this being a way of enhancing access to justice, and that seems to me, when I hear your comments and indeed read what you've written over the years, what drives us is not technology, but access to justice. And
well, I think, yes, if one looks at it optimistically, that's the end result we would like to have.
Yeah.
I don't know which. I have my doubts some days.
Yes, there's probably going to be a whole other conversation or two about the not so shining future, because there is, of course, the dark side of technology, which rears its ugly head from time to time. But here, the work that you've been doing is taking technology at its best and seeing what can be done to facilitate the kinds of resolution, access to justice, fulfilling of needs. It's a work in progress, as always, isn't it? In the same way that the law is a work in progress.
Well, I think what we do have are large numbers of people who have bought into the idea that you could resolve disputes online. I've been blessed with colleagues at UMass, particularly Leah Wing, who are as creative thinkers as I am about this.
Yeah.
It's still an open question. What will it be like in 5 or 10 years?
Well, I guess it has to be, because I mean, even if we go back 10 or so years, we would not have imagined the kind of ease of the conversation that we're having here. So there's that sort of confluence of technology, necessity, opportunity, and particularly in the case of people like yourselves, Ethan, the people who are there to both create and grab hold of the opportunities. One final thing, and this I hope will lead me into the next conversation, which I hope to have with the aforementioned Lee Wing. Technology and maybe other innovation often precedes ahead of the development of standards. And one of the things that ICODR and the National Center have been working very hard on is ensuring that there are suitable and correct standards, international standards for the use of technology. Any preliminary thoughts on that at this stage, where we're up to?
Well, I think it's the search for standards is a sign of not only of a need for standards, but of a maturing of the field.
Yep.
So that's what I think is happening currently. The maturing of the field doesn't necessarily happen without friction, but there's buy-in from lots of people. It's easy to forget that the ADR field, mediation and arbitration, aren't that much older than ODR.
Indeed.
But they got there first.
Well, by a whisker. And I suppose the parallel too is, if I think about my 40 years or so in the ADR field, is that as we develop the techniques of practice, and less the technologies, but the techniques, how we went about doing mediation and in some cases arbitration, there's a necessary parallel conversation of what the constraints on that were, how we should do that practice. So what we're doing in the ODR field is the same as happened in ADR and in law. There's always a need to be thinking about what the standards of practice may be. And of course, the conversation will continue as to whether this is one of the self-regulating fields or needs to be regulated by government agencies or others. But those conversations, I'm sure, will continue over the ensuing weeks. Ethan, I'm going to close in a couple of minutes, but it's always a pleasure to catch up with you. We've only met in person a couple of times, I think, in Paris in 2017 and in Auckland in 2018, but it feels as though it's much more familiar than that. So it's just a delight to see you again on screen. And it reassures us that, in fact, you can have a good catch up in a conversation with someone, even though we don't know each other that well. So it's my great delight to have had this chat with you as the inaugural conversation partner on these ODR podcasts. And privileged to talk with you because, as I mentioned at the outset, you are the pioneer leader and for many of us the mentor in the field. So I thank you for your time, and I look forward to seeing this podcast up on all the normal places where podcasts are located. So thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Yeah. Honored to do this.
Yeah. So I'm Ian McDuff, and this has been the inaugural podcast for the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. Thank you and goodbye.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODR, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODR or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.